and welcome back to the Logic Consortium. Today on the show, we're speaking with Israeli historian Ephraim Karsh about his 2010 book, Palestine Betrayed. And we're also going to be mentioning some other issues that are broader issues in the debates among historians about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Arab-Israeli conflict in general. So we're going to be talking about some of the main issues that he brings up in his book. I'm going to ask him to review some of the issues. And then I'm going to ask him about the general broader debate between the historians about the culpability of the parties for the refugee problem, the Palestinian refugee problem. So it's an interesting interview. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Logic Consortium. And here's our interview and our conversation with Professor Ephraim Karsh. Hello, Professor Karsh.
Yeah, I'm speaking.
Hi, this is Jacob Briskman from Chicago.
Yeah.
How are you?
Okay.
Do you? I was hoping we could talk today.
Yeah. I guess this is the idea. So, what do you have in mind?
Okay. Great. I kind of wanted to just talk about some of the issues brought up in your book and a couple of the related issues.
Okay, yeah.
All right. First of all, thank you so much for agreeing to take my call, and we really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you.
Yeah, no problem.
I first wanted to talk about the Jewish migration flows to the region from about the 1890s up until 1948. You mentioned in your book that there was not initial opposition from the people that were living there. That at the time the people living there looked at themselves as subjects and part of the Ottoman Empire. And with this dynamic, there was not nationwide opposition to the increasing Jewish migration. And that in 1917, the Balfour Declaration was not immediately opposed. And as you mentioned, throughout the mandate periods of there was the periods of peaceful coexistence were far longer and more common than those of violent conflict. Mm-hmm. And you've also talked about the positive socioeconomic, health, and welfare effects that the Jewish migration had on the people who were living in this area. Can you talk about all this a little bit?
Basically everything is in the book, but the point of the matter is that nationalism is an alien concept to the Middle East. I mean, the Middle East has been ruled since the rise of Islam by Islamic dynasties and empires. And the ranging principle has been religion, which is Muslim. It has been a Muslim empire, a Muslim state, in which, you know, society was organized according to religion. The Muslims on top, the rest of them down. So this is what happened, when the Ottoman Empire collapsed in the early 20th century. I mean, these peoples in the Middle East, with very few exceptions, I mean, like the Armenians, in any case, are Christians, and they developed their own national identity in the late 19th century. And the Ottoman Empire treated them very harshly, I mean, killing hundreds of thousands already in the late 19th century, early 20th century, then the genocide of World War I, which the Turks denied to this very day. And the other group was the Zionists, the Jews in Palestine, who were basically national community, but the rest of them were not. And they didn't feel like Arabs. They spoke Arabic, many of them. The elites, in fact, spoke Turkish. Even the elite of the Palestinian Arabs spoke Turkish, first language. And the famous Turkish subjects, Muslim subjects of the Ottoman Sultan. So there was no national identity, so they didn't feel threatened as such by the Zionists who were arriving there. In any case, it wasn't huge numbers, and the territory that came to be known as Palestine, which was basically, Ottoman province and a half, was not, very densely populated. I mean, we are talking about hundreds of thousands of people. Today you're having this territory in excess of 10 million. So it wasn't really very densely populated. They didn't feel as a nation. So why should they feel threatened of a declaration they even didn't hear about, you know? So it was not an issue. And even when the beginning of trouble ensued in 1920, in the riots in Jerusalem and the pogrom there, it wasn't about Palestine independence. It was about making this territory part of the Syrian Syrian kingdom that was established by a self-crowned King Hassan, Faisal, in 1918, so in 1920. So there was no national awareness, so there was no opposition to Zionism. These people, you could say that occasionally they might have been sporadic, ad hoc, very isolated, the cases of confrontation over land, over territory in the minimal sense of the word, but no more than that. And on the whole, they benefited from the arrival of Zionism. I didn't know the figures, so there's no point. I don't even remember all of them. But the point of the matter is that at the time of World War One and after World War One, there was a negative population growth in Palestine. People were leaving. People were dying and people were leaving the country. And after the Jews arrived and started developing the country, bringing money, establishing the villages, agricultural settlements, establishing cities, Tel Aviv was established, extending Haifa and other places, so then suddenly the Arab population of the same land started increasing. And that's what happened between the beginning of the British mandate in 1918 and or 1920, to be more precise, San Remo, and so forth. So if it were up to these people, I don't think there would have been a conflict. The conflict was created by the leadership.
And talking about the leadership, particularly Haj Amin al-Husseini, who was appointed as the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, a religious post, in 1921. And as you mentioned, around that time, he basically swore the Jews as his eternal enemies. He was a close associate with the Nazi leadership, or he became a close associate. And we learn from your book that he had meetings with Nazi leaders, including Hitler and Himmler, about the Jewish question. And this Mufti had quite a different outlook than the previous Mufti, Kamal Husseini, who you mentioned had the valued virtue of open-mindedness. Can you talk about Haj Amin al-Husseini, who became the Mufti, and his role in the conflict during this period, and his legacy vis-a-vis the conflict?
Haj Amin al-Husseini, which was one of the mistakes of Herbert Samuel, the first governor, the High Commissioner who appointed him, he was a Zionist and a Jew. So. But Husseini, of course, promised them to work for Arab-Jewish collaboration, but once appointed, he went in the precisely opposite direction. So he put the Palestinian Arabs on a collision course with the Jews from the beginning against their very wishes. So he incited several rounds of violence in 1921. He was involved already in 1920 when he was not Mufti. And then he ran away and he was sentenced, to prison. And then, because they couldn't implement it, so eventually they basically forgot about it. But then he came back in 21, there were violence, then 29, and then, of course, 36 to 39. And in the middle, he turned Jerusalem into a big issue, in Arab-Jewish relations between, until then nobody could care very much about Jerusalem. Jerusalem is shared only as a city to Islam, but of course you cannot put it in a power with Mecca and Medina, so under the Ottomans, it was a backwater, and suddenly the Mufti start renovating the mosque, and so on and so forth, and turning Jerusalem into a hot issue, which continues to this very day. I mean, you know, basically Arafat, when he started his war of terror in 2000, he called it an Aqsa Intifada, so it's the same system, the same method used by the Mufti in 1929, supposedly riots over, you know, the holy site in Jerusalem. And then he was forced to flee the country, you know, in 1937, in the course of the so-called uprising. And he went to Lebanon, then he went to Iraq, and then he colluded in Iraq with the pro-Nazi elements, and when the Iraqi government, the pro-Nazi putsch failed, he fled to Tehran, and from there he went to Italy, from there he went to Germany, and then he spent the long years there. So he was a rabid anti-Semite on top of everything, combining the Muslim, you know, anti-Jewish bigotry, or anti-Semitism, if you want to call it, going back to the Prophet Muhammad all the way through, with modern themes of Greek and anti-Semitism, like the protocols of the Elders of Zion, and blood libels, and so on and so forth, and he used them to incite his people against the Jewish national cause. And during the war, he collaborated with the Nazis. I mean, he tried to convince them, you know, to kill as many Jews as they can. I mean, not that they needed any persuasion. I mean, they did it on their own. But in this respect, I mean, their thinking really was completely complementary. He recruited the Muslim to a certain, to a lesser extent, probably Croatian forces to fight on the Eastern Front in Russia. He sent paratroopers to Palestine, you know, which was not very successful idea during the war. And of course, he agitated all the time on the German propaganda, radio and broadcast, and statements issued and so on, inciting the Muslims throughout the world to join the German force. So he was basically a Nazi collaborator. And after the war, in fact, the Yugoslavians wanted to prosecute him in Nuremberg, but he managed to escape because the French allowed him to return to Egypt. And there he stayed and created all the troubles that ensued in 1947-48. So, in a way, I mean, you always have this issue between, I don't know, wide historical developments and the role of personalities. So, this is one of the cases where you have personalities who exert, you know, major impact on the course of history. I think, in this respect, the Mufti is definitely one of the most important people in the history of 20th century Middle East. Without him, I don't think there would have been the Arab-Israeli conflict. Again, some other people may say different things, but obviously, I speak for myself on the basis of my own research. And the same applies, by the way, to Arafat, who took over the Palestinian cause, let's say, from the mid-late 60s after his death in 2004. I mean, you know, had he behaved in a different way, the conflict would have been resolved already decades ago. And this is the tragedy of the Palestinians, and this is the tragedy of the Israelis and the wider Middle East. The people who determine Palestinian history from the 1920s all the way to the 21st century, where, you know, this kind of bigoted extremists who couldn't care less about the national development of their own people and were more interested in destroying the national cause of other people, the Jews.
I have a little bit of a lengthy question about the contemporary debates among Israeli historians with respect to the conflict in 1948. From the headlines and the rhetoric, it seems that there's no agreement between the so-called new historians and old historians. But looking deeper into the debate, it seems to me that there's substantial agreement on very important aspects of the conflict. For example, everyone agrees on the intra-Arab self-interested behavior, that the people who spoke in the population's name represented neither their feelings nor their needs. And the Palestinian national movement, as you just articulated, has been rejectionist from the appointment of the Mufti through the Peel Commission report to partition through Arafat in the modern day.
I don't think so. The news don't say it at all. They say the opposite. I don't think they say it.
They don't?
And
Benny Morris's review of your book, he said that you were illuminating...
Benny Morris reviewed my book. It's full of lies in any case. So Benny Morris has changed, and I've been arguing with him over the last year. But if you read the original Benny Morris, the true Benny Morris, not the Benny Morris who speaks on newspapers, then you will get a completely different approach.
But it does seem...
Benny Morris speaks from both sides of his mouth, and these days he speaks from the side of house that to a large extent pleases Israel supporters, so they ignore the fact that he has another side that they don't want to look at.
But reading some other works, it does seem that there is blame laid by the new historians on the feet of the Arab leaders, saying that they were self-interested and didn't have the population's interest at heart. And I also want to go on real quick, if you'll let me, that there also seems to be ostensible agreement, as you so thoroughly reviewed in your book, that about the Arab and Palestinian leadership's role in the number of the refugees. A large number of the Arab-Palestinians left at the request of the Palestinian leadership, as you document, and this was for a number of reasons, that they were told that they would be taken hostage by Jews, that they should make way for the Arab invading armies, that there might be potential retribution from Arabs when they retook the towns, and they didn't want to be perceived as acquiescing to a Jewish state. And then finally, with respect to the role of the Haganah, Plan D, and then the Irgun and Lehi, and the roles that they played in the exodus and evacuation of those Palestinian Arabs that still remains, it seems to me that some of the disagreement, at least, is only semantic. Because both sides admit that the Jewish forces did expel from certain places, sometimes using violence, that some of the underground organizations didn't have the scruples in terms of attacks on civilians that the Haganah did. And with respect to Plan D, while defensive in nature, both sides seem to agree that it sought to turn the tables on the Arabs by seizing the operational initiative, that they preemptively wanted to stop attacks from the towns that served as the bases for Arab militias, and that this included going after mixed towns and sometimes expulsion of the population outside of the borders of the Jewish state. So what I'm saying is that that there seems to be overlap in agreement that despite the existence of emotionally charged disagreement. Could you comment on that?
I don't think so at all. I mean, Ilan Pappe wrote a book called The Ethnic Cleanses of Palestine, so how can you say that he agrees along the lines that you just discussed? On the contrary. You know, Benny Morris argued for years in his books and writings, and I fought him for over 10 years of agreement, that Zionism was based basically on the assumption on the desire to expel all the Palestinians, even though he said that he didn't find any claim indicating that this was the case during the war. But he said it didn't matter because this was the mindset. And he wrote about it many times, and even in our recent discussions, he didn't want to back down from his lies. So, no, there is a very fundamental argument between, they agree on small things, like you said, that, you know, the most serious scholars will admit that there are expansions from very limited places. But the new historians will argue that the expansions were much wider and reflected a wider pattern. So, of course, the new historians are basically giving the Arab approach. That's what they are doing. And they are not, I mean, you should read my book, The Fabricated Israeli History, or other articles. The new stories are not new. They didn't find anything new. They didn't go to the archives as they pretended to do. Morris admitted it later. He said that he wrote this in his books without the document. And then when I asked him, he said, oh, the archives are closed. But then I said, how can you call yourself a new historian if you always claim to have found it? He wants to have it both ways. So the new stones are not new. They didn't find anything new. They didn't come with a new argument. They didn't come with a new fact. What they are doing is recycling the Arab narrative. And the only thing that people pay attention to them is they are Israelis and they are useful idiots in the hands of the opposition. Because they can say, if Israelis argue that this is the case, it must be true. But the fact is that Israelis argue it or Jews for this matter, it doesn't make it true. It just makes these people, you know, very client to the other things for the wrong reason. And I won't get into the personal reasons of doing so. So they are not new and they are not historians because they are fabricating history. And the fact is that Maurice Kahn, after 15 years of writing books and articles supposedly based on, you know, archival material, suddenly changed his mind and present the opposite approach in newspaper without proving a shred of evidence to support it, indicates that he's not a real historian. But again, as I said, we are, you know, in the middle of the war that is still going on, and of course, people who support Israel are very pleased. They said, look, he changed his mind. You know, he can change his mind as much as he wants as a person. But as a historian, if you change your plans, you have to bring evidence. And he has never brought the opposite evidence, and he has never disowned anything he wrote before, which apparently you haven't read, because if you had read it, you would see that it's fundamentally opposed to what he's saying today. It's the opposite of what he's saying today.
Lastly, I was encouraged by a review of your book that I read, which talked about one of the main current schisms between is between the peace camps on both sides and their opponents. And then the reviewer went on to say that there needs to be a balance struck between the adversarial parties, and that he said your book will help in that process, in that it delves beneath the cliches and slogans to reveal the uncomfortable aspects of the Palestinian cause. Case. Can you comment on this and tell us what you think is the way forward to a peaceful resolution, and how your book might help with that?
I don't know if my book will help. I mean, I'm a realistic person, but my personal opinion, but this is a political opinion, it's not something that, you know, I can say is historical necessarily. I think the solution was there. I mean, the British brought the solution as early as 1937 in the Peace Commission. And the solution is partition, the two-state solution. I mean, you know, in this respect, you can say that my views are not different from those of Norris. We both believe in it. So the solution is two states, the Palestinians who accept that the Jews have the right to a state of their own, and the Jews have to accept it. The Jews have, in fact, accepted it in 37, not full-heartedly, but in 1947, they accepted it. And this is the partition resolution that was there. Palestinians have never accepted it to this very day, to my statement. I mean, not even the PLO, which pretended for some time to have accepted it. But then they revealed, at least to their own people and to the Arabic-speaking world, that they haven't accepted it. So once they do accept it and they proceed this way, I think there will be a solution. Because, but I don't know. I mean, you know, the book, it exposes the deeply flawed Palestinian leadership over the time. But many people criticize me for this, to say that, you know, for Israel, you know, you don't give the politicized, which I'm not in this respect. I mean, and that's, in fact, is another difference between me and the new story, in the sense that some of them, at least for some time, you know, argued that they supported the two-state solution, and so do I. But these people, in fact, try to rewrite history in a way that will be more compliant to the Arab narrative, in the belief that if they'll be nice to the Arabs and bend over backward, the Palestinians, would reward them by accepting the two-state solution, and this will be better. And this, in fact, is why Benny Morris changed in 2000. He didn't change before because he found new evidence in the archives to change his view of the conflict. He changed his view because Arafat behaved in a way that was unacceptable to him at a certain point. So, I mean, I think the solution is there, and it's been there for 80 years. You know, it's up to the Palestinians to recognize it and to act upon it. But if you look at the political map today, it's not very encouraging. I mean, the Hamas regime and Islamist movement is openly and adamantly opposed to it, and the PLO, which is a corrupt and repressive regime, is on the face of it, when it speaks to the West, supports the two-state solution, but when it speaks to its own people, it denigrates this solution. So the only way to move forward, if there is any, is for the international community to come and impose the two-state solution on the Palestinians, really. Because on the Israeli side, you don't have to make effort. The Israelis support it, with very few exceptions, who are, in any case, insignificant in the overall political order in Israel. I mean, the vast majority of Israelis are resigned to a two-state solution if the Palestinians are sincere and we leave them in peace.
Thank you so much for this conversation. I really appreciate the opportunity of speaking with you. I was trying by that second penultimate question, I was really trying to identify some areas of agreement. And I thought I did in the things that I laid out. I think there might be some more areas of agreement than is commonly recognized between the two camps of historians.
I don't think so, but yeah, I mean, they made some tactical agreements about here and there that the Arab regimes didn't care about the Palestinians, for sure. This you can say, but not regarding Zionism as such and its intentions and so on and so forth. I mean, you know, Benny Morris, in one of his essays, which he wrote in 1990 or 89, something like this, it's in the book that he called 1948 and After. He summarizes the position of their plan. So if you read it, you see exactly what they're saying. And then you can try and see whether they can correspond to their position.
Okay, I'm definitely going to try to keep scouring over the record. And maybe I could contact you again in about 6 months or so.
Yeah, no problem. Yeah.
And thanks so much. I really enjoyed your book, and it was very eye-opening in terms of the revelations that it gave about the Arab leadership's contribution.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased that people enjoy it and learn.
You're listening to the Logic Consortium, and that was our interview and conversation with Israeli historian Ephraim Karsh. So thanks so much for listening, and you can find other interviews about this topic and other topics at logicconsortium.blogspot.com. Have a great day.